So I want you to think about maybe your favorite comic book or even a long-running movie franchise that you really love.
Right, the ones that go on for decades.
Exactly. Because there is this very specific kind of unspoken rule that we all agree to when we consume these stories. The hero gets pushed to the absolute brink.
Oh, yeah, the giant lasers pointed right at the Earth.
The countdown clock is at 1 second. The sky is literally falling. But at the last possible moment, someone pulls the plug.
Right.
They win, the world is saved, and we hit that familiar reset button so everything can just go back to normal for the sequel.
Because fundamentally, destroying your setting means you are destroying the very place your fans are paying money to spend time in. I mean, the apocalypse is almost always a bluff. You can threaten the status quo, but you can never actually break it.
Until suddenly, a creator decides the bluff is over.
Right.
So today's deep dive is based on this fascinating essay we found. It's titled, "The Day a Company Murdered Its Own World."
It is such a good title.
It really is.
Yeah.
And we're looking at this moment in 2015 when Games Workshop, the company behind the massive tabletop game Warhammer Fantasy, did the unthinkable.
They really did.
I mean, they had this beloved, deeply rich fantasy setting that had been growing for 30 years. And they didn't just threaten it. They didn't just, have the heroes narrowly lose a battle.
No, they physically tore the planet apart.
Yes, they killed off the gods and permanently ended the world.
Which is just a phenomenal case study in both narrative risk and corporate strategy. So we are going to explore exactly how this apocalypse played out in the fiction.
Which is a brutally fascinating ride all on its own.
Oh, absolutely. But we are also going to look at the cold, hard boardroom logic that actually forced a company to deliberately murder its most valuable creation.
Okay, let's unpack this, because before we get to the actual destruction of the world, you really need to understand the rhythm of this universe.
Right, this wasn't your standard high fantasy setting.
No, not at all. The essay describes the world that was, which by the way is what they call it now that it's gone, as this dark fantasy planet with a ticking clock. The good guys were always slowly losing.
Yeah, the fundamental tension in Warhammer Fantasy was always a losing battle. The world was constantly menaced by chaos.
And chaos in this universe isn't just like an abstract concept of disorder, right?
Exactly. It is literal, raw, malevolent magic leaking into reality, and it corrupts absolutely everything it touches.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's leaking through this physical wound at the northern pole of the planet, which was accidentally torn open at the dawn of time by the world's godlike creators.
Old ones.
Right, old ones.
That sets such a bleak tone right out of the gate. I mean, the creators messed up, left a gaping hole in reality, and now literal demons are just pouring out of the planet's own North Pole.
And because of that unending leak of chaos, the war between order and chaos was never one the forces of order could actually win. They could only ever postpone defeat.
Just buying time.
Exactly. The human empire held the line because every few centuries, a legendary hero would arrive to plug the dam for just one more lifetime. It created this recurring nightmare cycle of invasions and saviors.
And the sources highlight two major times this happened before the end. So the first was the Great War Against Chaos. You have this warlord named Ossivar Cul, and he gets crowned the Ever Chosen.
Which means he is the single champion anointed by all four of the Chaos Gods.
Right. And he just unleashes hell. The essay actually mentions this terrifying detail to illustrate the stakes here. His army overruns a northern city called Prague.
Yeah, the fall of Prague.
But they don't just burn it down. The raw magic of chaos physically melts the city. The screaming citizens are like warped and fused alive into the very stone walls and cobblestones.
It's one of the setting's signature images of horror, and it establishes that the stakes aren't just, losing territory or paying taxes to a new king.
Right.
It's a fundamental corruption of reality itself. If chaos wins, the very laws of physics and biology dissolve.
But sticking to that cycle of saviors you mentioned, the empire survives. A charismatic leader named Magnus the Pious reunites the humans, marches north, and breaks the invasion.
Plugging the dam for another couple of centuries.
Exactly. Which brings us to the second major invasion, the Storm of Chaos. A new Ever Chosen, a guy named Archaon, marches in the city of Middenheim to snuff out this sacred flame.
And a messianic warrior named Valton rises up to stop him.
Right, so the clock is ticking toward midnight again. But here is where the story actually spills over into the real world. Games Workshop didn't just write a book about this.
No, they didn't.
They let the actual players decide the outcome through a massive global tabletop campaign.
Yeah, players would go to their local hobby stores, they'd play matches with their painted armies, and log the results online.
Which is so cool.
It really is. The company aggregated all those thousands of real-world games to dictate the official storyline. It is an incredible way to engage an audience, giving them true agency over the narrative.
But the players won.
They did.
The forces of order repelled the invasion. The world survived. And what Games Workshop did next was they quietly wiped that player victory from existence.
Yeah, they completely retconned it.
For anyone unfamiliar, a retcon is retroactive continuity. It's when the writers basically erase something from the official canon. They just unwrote the storm of chaos.
Yeah.
Arcane's defeat suddenly never happened.
Because what's fascinating here is that this retcon was a massive signal of a shift in authorial intent. The creators basically took back the steering wheel from the fans.
Right.
They erased a hard-fought, real-world community victory just so Arcane could march on Middenheim again. And this time, they were making sure the fans wouldn't be allowed to stop him.
It's honestly like playing a massive online video game for hundreds of hours, organizing your friends, spending all your resources, and finally beating the ridiculously hard final boss. And then the developers forcibly patch your game to say your save file doesn't count. Why? Because the boss was actually supposed to win, and they need him alive for the sequel. I mean, it is so brutal to the people who invested their time.
It feels like a total betrayal to the player base, certainly, but it was a necessary runway for what the company was planning. I mean, they were preparing to deliberately drive the car off a cliff.
So imagine you're a fan who has spent a decade painting these miniatures and reading these novels, right? And suddenly, between 2014 and 2015, Games Workshop releases The End Times.
This was a 5-volume series of thick, expensive narrative books.
And instead of just saying, oh, a giant meteor hits the planet, game over, they executed this meticulous, controlled demolition of the universe. They systematically dismantled every single pillar of the lore, theme by theme.
The structural metaphor of a controlled demolition is absolutely perfect here. They targeted the foundational factions one by one, ensuring that by the time the final blow fell, there was literally nothing left holding the ceiling up.
Wow.
And the escalation begins with the dead.
Right. The first major narrative pillar to fall is in the book Nagash. So he is the setting's original necromancer, this ancient prince, who literally invented the magic of undeath.
Yes.
Two of his servants, Arkhan the Black and Manfred von Karstein, decide to bring him back to life. But to do it, they capture and sacrifice this innocent elf princess of pure soul named Aliathra.
And when Nagash returns from the grave, he isn't just a powerful wizard anymore. He absorbs the ambient magic of the world and comes back as a living god of death.
The power scaling immediately just goes off the charts. The rules of the universe are completely fracturing.
Oh, and we see this accelerate when the plague god's champions, the Glotkin, invade the empire. The human emperor, Karl Franz, is brutally killed in battle.
The beacon of human hope is extinguished.
Exactly. But then his body is struck by a bolt from the heavens, and he is reborn as Sigmar incarnate. He becomes the literal avatar of his own patron god, wielding the legendary warhammer Gul-Mrath.
Though old characters are dying and just being remade into towering demigods, the narrative restraint is totally gone at this point.
Completely gone.
But the elven storyline in the Cain book is where I genuinely have to pause, because things get so incredibly dark. The elves have this magical island continent called Ulthuan. During this apocalypse, the entire continent literally sinks beneath the ocean.
Millions drown.
Yeah. The elven guides are killed. Their greatest shining hero, Tirion, gets corrupted and dies. And then, the twist. Wait, so they didn't just kill off the heroes, they actively validated the villains.
They really did.
Because the great villain of the elves is Malekith. This guy has been the ultimate bad guy, this burned, spiteful witch king trying to destroy his own people for 7,000 years.
Right.
And at the end of the world, the story reveals he was actually the rightful heir to the throne all along. They give the ultimate child-murdering villain the crown and make him the Eternity King. That feels like a massive slap in the face to anyone who spent years playing the good guys.
What's fascinating here is that, yeah, it feels incredibly jarring if you view it through the lens of traditional high fantasy, like Tolkien.
Right.
But this perfectly encapsulates the grim logic of Warhammer. The universe doesn't care about moral desert or karma. Validating a 7,000-year-old monster highlights that the impending doom is twisting reality itself into something completely unrecognizable.
Wow.
It subverts those traditional tropes to show the reader that the old rules of good triumphing over evil simply do not apply anymore. It's actually a beautifully cynical narrative choice.
Cynical is the exact perfect word for it, and it just keeps escalating, because next we have the Thankwall book, where the Skaven make their move.
Right, the rat men.
Yeah, these rat men who live in a teeming subterranean civilization beneath the world. Usually in the lore, they are kind of darkly comic, like they're constantly scheming and betraying each other, so they never actually achieve anything.
Yeah, but in the end times, they unify.
They swarm the surface in numbers no one thought were physically possible. They pull a moon out of orbit. They drown the jungle lizard men, they swarm the dwarves and mountains, and topple Karazak Arrak, which is the greatest fortress of the world.
The Undercity literally swallows the surface.
It's insane.
And that Skaven invasion serves a very specific structural purpose. It eliminates the physical strongholds of the world, setting the stage for a desperate final act at Middenheim. The surviving characters have literally nowhere else to go.
Right.
And they form an alliance around an elegant magical concept called the Incarnates.
Okay, let me explain the Winds of Magic for a second, because this is crucial for the final book, Archaon. So there are 8 colored streams of raw sorcerous power blowing across the world.
Things like fire, death, heaven's light.
Yeah, it's almost like the Infinity Stones from Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
In these final hours, the magic is so dense that 8 champions each absorb one of these winds into their bodies to keep reality from dissolving.
So Karl Franz holds the heavens, Nagash gets death, Malekith gets fire.
And an elven mage named Teclis gets light. They basically weaponize the very fabric of reality to face Archaon, who is now the Lord of the End Times.
And in theory, these 8 incarnates should be enough. They represent the ultimate superhero team-up of this universe. But the story delivers its final fatal blow not through overwhelming demonic strength.
But through the ultimate human flaw. Internal betrayal.
Exactly.
At the absolute worst possible second, while they are casting the spell to save the world, Manfred von Karstein and Nagash turn on the living. The alliance collapses from within.
The essay acutely points out that the dead never were team players. And because of that betrayal, the magical defense breaks.
Yeah.
The Skaven detonate a catastrophic device in the world's underworld. And the planet, which is actually only named Malice in its own obituary, physically shatters.
The core just explodes. The chunks of rock drift off into the void. There's no last minute save, no reset button. The world is completely irreversibly dead.
It is a breathtaking piece of destruction. But to truly understand why this event happened, we have to look behind the curtain. We have to pivot away from the magical apocalypse and look at the real world boardroom.
Right, because this entire narrative was downstream of a massive financial crisis. Wait, so looking at the essay's breakdown of the business side, this means the End Times wasn't really a narrative climax at all. This was just a corporate product launch wearing the costume of an apocalypse.
That is the exact reality of the situation. By the early 2010s, the tabletop game Warhammer Fantasy Battle was in deep existential trouble. The essay outlines 3 massive real-world problems facing Games Workshop that forced their hand.
Okay.
First, you have entirely stagnant sales.
Let's break down why the sales were stagnant.
Hmm.
The game was built around what they call rank-and-file armies.
Mm.
When you played, you didn't just move 1 or 2 cool heroes around, you had to move massive, regimented square blocks of dozens of identical infantry figures.
Right.
You needed like 50 spearmen in a perfect rectangle just to play.
And the financial bottleneck there is so obvious. Once a player spends the hundreds of dollars to buy those 50 spearmen and spends the weeks required to assemble and paint them, they're done.
Yeah, they just reuse those exact same models for the next 20 years.
Exactly. Games Workshop only survives if they continuously sell new plastic kits. If the core veteran players aren't buying new armies, the business model fundamentally chokes on its own game design.
That makes perfect sense. So the second problem was the rule set. After 30 years of supplements and expansions, the rules had grown into this dense, terrifying thicket. You didn't just roll a die and say, I hit you.
Far from it.
You had to check complex line-of-sight arcs, yeah, cross-reference multiple tables, and literally argue over fractional inches on a tape measure.
Yeah.
You could spend 45 minutes just resolving a single combat between 2 units.
It was actively hostile to newcomers. And a physical hobby, like miniature wargaming, dies without a constant intake of new players to replace the ones who age out. The barrier to entry had simply become too high.
Right.
But the third problem, this was the existential threat that truly drove the demolition: intellectual property.
Yes. The names of their factions were legally worthless.
I mean,
they had built a 30-year empire on armies called the Empire, High Elves and Dwarves. You cannot trademark generic English words or concepts ripped straight out of public domain mythology in Tolkien.
If you are a trademark lawyer for Games Workshop, this is a nightmare. Any rival 3D printing company or miniature manufacturer can sculpt a tall guy with pointy ears, put it in a box labeled High Elf, and sell it for half the price.
Wow.
Games Workshop couldn't protect its market share because it didn't own the words. This is the exact same logic that led their incredibly successful sci-fi game, Warhammer 40,000, to aggressively rename their factions.
Right. They changed the space elves from the generic Eldar to the proprietary Eldari.
Exactly. They needed nouns they could legally own and fiercely litigate.
So you look at those three problems. Veteran players aren't buying rank-and-file models. New players are bouncing off the mat-heavy rules. And competitors can freely use the names you do have. Patching the rules wouldn't fix the trademark issue.
No.
Changing the names wouldn't fix the stagnant model sales.
They needed a completely clean slate. It was a cold, radical, and frankly, brilliant business decision. They didn't just reboot the game with an awkward press release. They leveraged the 30 years of deep lore to create a mythic, unforgettable finale that fans would buy in droves.
Yeah.
They basically burned down a house they couldn't defend to build a new one on ground they completely owned.
So they've literally shattered the planet. They blew up 30 years of history. But Games Workshop is still a miniatures company. They still have to sell plastic toys tomorrow morning.
Right.
How do you pull a brand new, legally distinct universe out of the ashes of the old one without totally alienating the fans?
You take the abstract magic of the dead world and you literalize it.
The transition in the lore here is genuinely beautiful. Remember how we said the planet shattered? Sigmar, the mortal emperor who became a god, doesn't die in the vacuum of space.
No, he survives.
His spirit clings to the shattered, glowing metallic core of the dead planet, which is now streaking across the void like a twin-tailed comet. Which, by the way, is a fantastic callback for the fans, because that was his holy symbol in the old world.
It is a great detail.
So he drifts through the dark for an age until he is rescued by Dracothian, a vast star dragon who is essentially a living constellation. The dragon takes him to a completely new cosmos.
And this new cosmos is the Mortal Realms. This is the setting for the new game, Warhammer Age of Sigmar. It's vital to understand that this is not a sequel setting on the same planet.
Right.
The old dirt and grass are gone. The Mortal Realms are eight enormous, distinct worlds made of pure, crystallized magic. They were formed from those same eight winds of magic that bled out of the dying world during the apocalypse.
So Izir is the realm of heavens, which becomes Sigmar's pristine domain. Shaiish is the realm of death, ruled by a resurrected Nagash. And these vast flat worlds are all stitched together by magical doorways called realm gates.
And the timeline of this new universe is structured to rhyme with the tragedy of the old one. It starts with an age of myth. Sigmar builds a pantheon of order with the surviving gods, and they build shining utopian civilizations across the realms.
But a universe without conflict doesn't sell war games.
Exactly. So inevitably comes the age of chaos. Archaon survived the apocalypse too, because villains that good get to keep their jobs.
Obviously.
Archaon returns, and Nagash betrays the pantheon, proving once again the dead are terrible team players.
Right.
And chaos overruns everything except the heavens. Sigmar seals himself away in Azir for centuries while the other realms burn. But when he finally opens the gates to strike back, he unleashes his ultimate solution to Games Workshop's trademark problem.
The Stormcast Eternals.
Yes.
During his centuries of exile, Sigmar has been secretly taking the souls of the greatest mortal heroes from the lower realms, bringing them to the heavens, and reforging them on magical anvils with celestial lightning.
It's such a cool concept.
They become immortal, giant, golden thunder knights. And crucially, the phrase Stormcast Eternals is a string of words no competitor can ever touch.
Never.
They are a wholly unique concept. They are the shiny, fully trademarkable new face of the franchise.
It is the perfect synthesis of commerce and art. The lawyers get their bulletproof intellectual property, and the game designers get elite, heavily armored models that don't require players to paint blocks of 50 identical spearmen.
Yeah.
But what makes it actually resonate with the fans is that Games Workshop didn't make this new world a cheap, consequence-free superhero utopia.
Right. Here's where it gets really interesting. If they had just made these guys invincible, it would have been boring. But there's a tragic catch built into these new golden poster boys.
Yeah.
Every time a Stormcast Eternal is killed on the battlefield, their soul flashes into lightning and flies back to the heavens to be reforged into a new body. They can't permanently die, but every time that hammer falls on the anvil, the reforging scrapes away a little bit of their memory, a little bit of their warmth, their humanity. After 10 deaths, they might not remember their mortal families. After 20, they are little more than cold, unfeeling automatons of war. Immortality has a terrible compounding price. They solve the business problem, but they successfully smuggle the old, pessimistic soul of Warhammer right into the center of the shiny new setting.
That specific detail is exactly why this creative destruction ultimately worked. They honored the grim tone of the world they destroyed. They treated the audience's intelligence with respect, even while entirely rebooting the product line.
So bringing us back to the present day, we have to look at the scorecard. Games Workshop burned down 30 years of beloved history to fix their IP and their rule set. Did this massive existential gamble actually pay off?
Unequivocally, yes. Age of Sigmar had a very rocky start, as you would fully expect from fans actively grieving their old world, but it matured and grew into a massive success. It is now a highly profitable pillar of the company.
But the essay reveals the ultimate delicious irony in all of this.
Yeah.
In 2024, nearly a decade after blowing up the planet, Games Workshop resurrected it. They launched a new, specialized tabletop game called The Old World, set a few hundred years safely before the events of the end times.
It is the final, undisputed victory of the boardroom. They prove that in the realm of corporate storytelling, even death is just a product line.
Wow.
They successfully executed the apocalypse, reaped the massive financial rewards of the new trademarked universe, and now they are selling the very world they destroyed right back to the nostalgic fans at the exact same time.
It's incredible. They are successfully selling both the apocalypse and the world they blew up simultaneously.
Yeah.
Which leaves us with a really fascinating thought to chew on as consumers of media.
Yeah.
If a company can successfully murder its own beloved world to save its business model and actually come out richer on the other side, what does that mean for us as fans? We invest our emotions and our thousands of hours into these massive, endless universes. We are ultimately subservient to trademark law and quarterly earnings.
Right.
Will we see a future where beloved pop culture franchises routinely schedule massive universe-ending apocalypses every 30 years just to refresh their IP copyrights? When the hero is on the brink and the countdown clock is at 1 second, maybe the most profitable thing to do isn't to hit the reset button. Maybe the most profitable thing is to let the laser fire.
A very sobering thought for anyone heavily invested in a fictional universe.
Absolutely. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the stories behind your favorite media, and we will see you next time.